My Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're going to have an interesting show dealing with principles of prosperity. And many people think of prosperity as being some way, a very material, non-spiritual idea. And I'm going to be talking about prosperity in a totally different way than that. So, as usual, a bit of maybe a few surprises tonight, and also a different way to look at this whole area of thought. To begin with, let's talk about what I mean by prosperity, because prosperity, as I said, oftentimes is at least connotated with some type of, you know, more or less, maybe not greed, but more or less a focus on the material side of existence. And prosperity, in the terminology that I'm going to be using, means prosperous not just in some elements of the material world, but also prosperity in terms of emotions and feelings. And then also prosperity in terms of the thought that people might have. So if you're prosperous in thought, meaning that your thinking has less effort and greater results, then that's another way of finding prosperity. I'm going to start, though, with the more traditional idea that there's some relationship between prosperity and material aspects. Some people would say that prosperity is usually determined by one's net worth. In other words, how much do you have in material, or the ability to get material, which is usually represented by money. And that would be a kind of, we'll say, traditional way that has been assigned to this word. But again, even that has a different meaning when we're looking at it in spiritual terms. First thing to think about is this. If there is a lack of prosperity, even in the material sense, it reduces the amount of the following. Growth. So you grow less in every way possible. A lack of health. Why? Well, we'll get to that. A lack of the potential to be creative. In other words, someone has a certain potential of creativity, as they lack prosperity, their ability to be creative will be lessened. Another way of examining this is a lack of prosperity leads to a eventual point of loss of freedom and the ability to have liberty. Okay? Again, I'll go into the whys of this, the concepts behind it. But for right now, I want to at least have some basic, we'll call it underlying definitive understandings. Also, prosperity gives people the ability to communicate more, to be the ability to interact better together, and interact with the environment and things in the environment, including animals, plants, anything. It also, if a person has more prosperity, they have the ability to withstand the most important element that causes prosperity to become lost, and that's forces. So when forces are around us, if we have greater prosperity, we can find more ways to, we'll say, reduce the effects of the forces. The forces themselves may not be reduced in an innate sense, but the effects of them on those who are prosperous is considerably less. All of that comes from prosperity. Now, here's an interesting idea. Because of the anti-capitalistic, anti-free market viewpoint of a considerable portion of the world, and even here where I'm speaking from in the United States. The problem with that mode of thinking is that it condemns prosperity, and it attempts to reduce prosperity to a, we'll say, an average of all people being equal to share in everyone else's prosperity, which means prosperity doesn't exist because you're eliminating the difference between being prosperous and not, and that has some serious problems in it. To begin with, though, if you were to take all the prosperity that exists and were to average it out, before we go on with how terrible that might be in terms of future prosperity, in an immediate sense, it would cause the people who used to be prosperous to become embittered and enslaved, and it would cause the people who were being redistributed to the prosperity of others, some people call it wealth, to become wasteful and to not appreciate in a sense of all the things I just defined of prosperity, those things, because they didn't do what it takes to create prosperity in themselves, and they will fairly quickly destroy even the much lower level, but still greater than they ever had, of prosperity when it's redistributed to them. So in those kinds of circumstances, you end up with a lose-lose situation. The only people who benefit from a system such as redistribution are people who oftentimes are connected with the power element and the forces that are behind the redistribution method, because you can't redistribute prosperity without using undue force against those who have it. And you can't do so without destroying those that are being redistributed to, because they don't know how to deal with a world that has so much freedom and so much lack of forces that they never created for themselves. The odd part about this is that the idea of prosperity has to do with people becoming eventually much less selfish and developing a system in themselves of reducing forces, eventually not for themselves, but for everyone else as well. Because, this is a big important point, forces can never be, in a long-term sense, reduced by just focusing in on a few, and especially on oneself, because when one tries to only reduce the forces on oneself, it creates a vacuum, and more forces become, we'll say, increasingly introduced into the person's interactions with all other people. And this is a lesson that must be learned, not one that unfortunately is easily taught, or even with great difficulty taught. It really requires some degree of learning with a whole lot of teaching from virtually birth on. Now, in our present reality, within the present circumstances that the world is in, from one generation to the next, the information that I'm talking about becomes lost. Why in the heck would that be, since it seems like this is a very important subject to try to teach to your children and to have in your school systems, etc. Prosperity is almost never taught in public schools today, nothing about economics or prosperity are reasonably taught. And the problem that we have is that if we're going to consider how to deal with it on a familiar level, we need to have a populace that has within themselves more than just a knowledge of prosperity, but the desire to make it part of everybody's life, not just their own, not just their children's, but everybody that they come in contact with, because the real answer to understanding prosperity is to see the big picture of it. The big picture is never redistribution of wealth. And it's not, and this is going to sound terrible, it is not giving in a charitable sense to others in most circumstances. Now, the reason it sounds terrible is because I know most religions and a lot of good people think charity is very useful and highly important. Charity based upon soul issues is very important. Giving to others so that they become better givers. Highly, the most extreme importance. But giving to others for selfish reasons or for even, we'll say, personal reasons, which are mixed between selfishness and non-selfishness, has with it terrible consequences because it leads to the same problem as redistribution. The people that receive the charity don't appreciate the charity in the best ways that could help them to create more prosperity for themselves. And instead, it leads them to become, in many respects, less prosperous. That's a big problem. It's even worse when you consider welfare, as it is traditionally used in most of the societies in the world. Then you get to, it gets worse than charity. You get this whole thing to a very high level of escalation where people see that kind of receiving as something they deserve to have because it's an entitlement by just being present, being officially a citizen of XYZ country. And therefore, because they're a citizen, they automatically are entitled to it, like it's maybe it will be in some countries, but it's in the Constitution. You get it, you know, that sort of thing. Here in the United States, there's no such thing, but in our laws, the laws are not constitutional so that we have it in there mistakenly. Now, the issue here becomes, how do you know that you're giving it away that's going to help people to become more giving rather than more selfish? And that's a whole other part of today's program. But for right now, I think it's important as we just try to examine what I mean by prosperity that we get various glimpses, various examples, so that it makes some sense as I get into other parts of the subject. So there's a whole other dimension to the word prosperity. It doesn't mean what it is usually assumed to mean because it's almost the antithesis, meaning the opposite of what is oftentimes thought of by some people, anyway. Now, there's certainly many people who believe in free markets who think prosperity is a good thing. But then they may be looking at it strictly from a material, more selfish side of the fence. Why is it that some of the things I just said are true? Why is it that if a person is selfishly, apparently prosperous, why will they eventually lose that prosperity through all the different possible ways in which I'm going to give you some of them? Well, the first is their consciousness gets lower as they become more and more greedy in their prosperity instead of helping others to be prosperous while they enjoy it themselves. That causes them in lower consciousness to not be able to deal with health issues, which they bring onto themselves through forces of their life being selfish. And then, besides the health issues, which often tend to be the Achilles heel of even the most prosperous of people, you also deal with the factors that seemingly are almost nebulous because there's so many different ways that they may become connected to other people. It's hard to see how it's really happening, but let me put it this way. If you are prosperous and you don't try to help other people to become prosperous, and that means you've got to teach them, you've got to be willing to share with them, you've got to be able to sometimes just assist them, provided they're willing to do the same thing in return to others. It's a pay it forward kind of idea. And you know that's really going to happen. Then the result is a model, so to speak, that reduces forces because each person that becomes more willing to give themselves reduces the overall forces in all those that are connected to them and with them in any way possible. So if you're connected with them, you have to be if you're going to give them anything. The result is that amazingly, the forces over time reduce dramatically, especially as a person is doing this with tens, hundreds, who knows how many people, the forces go way down. This is strange for most people to believe because we think that we're all kind of separate from everybody else, so it wouldn't matter if you helped anybody else to become prosperous so that they can help others or not. Things wouldn't change for you, but they do. They do in radical ways. We are all connected, whether we want to believe it or not. And eventually the people who become prosperous but are selfish will become competitors in ways which are devious and destructive. And if they do not become prosperous because you're withholding or you're not helping them, then they become jealous and become hostile to those who are prosperous. They become envious and ruthless in attempting, oftentimes in a criminal way, in attempting to acquire that which they think others have undeservingly because it was never shared with them so that they could become more prosperous but also more giving at the same time. This is a key understanding, and it is not well understood. It was part of the Christian religion at one point. It has gotten confused over time, partly because the sixth ray, which deals with religions, has been out of focus for, well over a century now, and its change in focus has weakened the effects of religion. And the sects that follow this principle have not defined it as well, and some of it's become lost. If we look at the whole process, it becomes strangely like Darwinian evolutionary ideas. Now, this is so strange because there's so many people today who claim to be quote-unquote scientific in their thinking or progressive in some respects, meaning that they believe partly in redistribution, among other things. Yet, they don't recognize that the principles of prosperity have a lot to do with the principles of Darwinian evolution. Not to say that isn't also part of God. It is, as a matter of fact. Well, because God created Darwinian evolution. It's part of how people and other living things develop, but part of it, not fully. Humans especially develop because they have a sense of God, their own creator. But it's so fascinating to watch this because if you watch how animals become quote-unquote prosperous, they do so by being creative at their own level of creation. And they do so by being, skilled and successful in the use of both senses and whatever level of conscious thought that they have. Those things allow them to survive better and longer than other animals of the same type and different types. And so they have a certain level of prosperity. It's very small in comparison to what a human can do. But it has, even at the lowest levels, you can see that there's some element to this idea. And the forces affect you less when you're prosperous. Let's talk about that. Because prosperity gives you the ability to come together with time and energy and effectively use it when needed to join time with space and have an effect on energy that reduces force on the events that a person has happening with them and that they are participating in. This is huge. Someone who is prosperous can muster a tremendous amount of offsetting force in comparison to someone who isn't. And the results could be tremendously advantageous. At the same time, can lead to greater health and longer life. And the most important thing, maybe to some people, more meaning in that life that comes from the higher level of creativity, followed by a greater level of consciousness. Balancing the two is the key to prosperity. And that's going to be the key to tonight's show. If you balance your creativity with your consciousness, which is also the same thing as saying unconditional love or soul love, you have almost an instant increase in prosperity. And it grows the more consistently someone does this. Now, what about people who, you know, want to give half of their fortune away? Is that a bad thing? You know, there's so many people seemingly who think that that's a way of living. It's not a terrible thing. If you were very judicious in how you chose to do that, which is seldom the case, by the way, and you're really trying to help other people to gain in prosperity as by doing the same things, becoming more creative, and at the same time, more giving in ways that helps others to become more creative and more giving. If you're helping people to do that, then big time, you're doing a great thing. And if you want to give every penny you got to that, you'll probably be okay because it wouldn't matter. Because then you're truly building this whole concept. And you can say, how could you give everything away and still be prosperous? Because if you did it in the way I just said, you would ultimately gain many times what you gave away, even though you may not be trying to do that. That's exactly what would happen. Sounds impossible, like it's magic, something or other, but it's not. It's based upon principles in ageless wisdom, which have been tried for a long time and been proven to work. There's so few people who do this that it's hard for us to find examples, although there are some out there. And they, even though it sounds impossible, once you see the example working, people say, oh yeah, I get it now. Because everybody's interconnected and all the forces are going, you can do almost anything now. If you gave all your money away today, all your possessions away today, and you had nothing in terms of the material sense of things, you would gain all that many times over if you did it by doing so for souls and you help people to do the same thing themselves for everyone else. Because the world around you becomes so effortless, so without force, that everybody would, that you did this for, would be so grateful. There would be a ton of gratitude poured in and many other great elements of soul-like factors. So you can't lose doing that. Okay, what happens in times when things go very wrong? Let's say there's a huge epidemic of the worst kind of disease, and someone gives away a good deal of their prosperity in trying to help those who are trying to help others. What would that do then? Well, first of all, there's a likelihood the disease would be stopped through some kind of preventative something methodology. But beyond that, the whole purpose of prosperity is not to just gain the wealth of this world. It's also to become emotively prosperous, and that's a whole other thing, that's where a person's feelings are so filled in by love that they don't live just to have things. They live to have the feeling of greatness in everyone else in as a soul. And that is what they live for, so call it universal love. And then they also live for ideas and for the ability to help others to think in more creative ways, growing in consciousness because they can take knowledge and expand it and use it in many unique and new ways that literally creates new knowledge and helps others to become more conscious as well. This is the process that leads to a kind of prosperity that is well beyond the physical world in and of itself. People that are living in the physical world tend to focus much more on prosperity within this world because the forces are so brutal that just to make it tolerable, some people seek some level of prosperity just from the sheer suffering of the forces. In the astral world, after we die and live there, the forces are so much reduced that people aren't prosperous just as a defensive element, and they can get out of the self-focus that is so oftentimes labored, that is a labor for people who are physically alive. And so in the astral world, and especially the mental, one can become prosperous with greater ease, and the most amount of that will be soul level of giving in comparison with the physical world. This is good because it means that this is our roughest time here, and even if we fail here, we do have other chances elsewhere to gain in prosperity and to help others to do the same. All right, so freedom and consciousness in use of prosperity leads to incredible changes in the force level in life. And if we can achieve relatively higher levels, we live a relatively effortless life. The less effort needed to be in one's creativity, the greater the levels of expression of that creativity, especially in intelligent interactions with other people and things. This is while we're physically alive. And this is the wonder of having a life that does this. Now, going back to what I said earlier, if you live in a system that is presently highly communistic or socialistic, a communistic is a method of forcibly redistributing wealth, and socialism is a method of doing it through government legal systems, mostly to take over major industries. Both do pretty much the same thing, but one does it in a more ungodly way, which is communism. But each has within it the same elements. It lowers the general level of prosperity because as you remove the prosperity or wealth from those people who have it and you give it to people who didn't earn it, the results are the following. The people who have it lost are the most creative people in the society. Their creativity ceases because they're enslaved by the system, and they have little opportunity to do much with their creativity. They may become depressed or hostile, but they certainly aren't going to be able to be very creative because you need to have prosperity to do that. Okay, so you've taken it away. And you say, well, that's okay because I'm going to give it all to, or most of it, I'll take my piece of it if I'm the government. But I'll give most of it to the people who don't have it. Now everybody has an equal share. While the people who don't have it didn't have it in the first place because they weren't being creative. and because they weren't being universally loving enough, or both. So they're selfish and lack creativity. You give them the prosperity, and what they do is they become even lazier. They become less likely to create with what they have, and instead they use it up in ways that are tremendously force increasing. Why? Let me show you how that works. The people that get the wealth of others, and they become more prosperous, but in relative terms, they don't seek to be creative, and they don't seek to universally give to others so that they will become more giving. They instead seek to have experiences that add to their excitement, increase their desires by doing so, and cause them to become what is known in spiritual terms more glamour. Those glamours eat up far more of their consciousness and their senses. So they become less empathic, they become less able to, let's say, correctly or adequately or, say, intelligently feel. Their feelings are based upon illusions, and then with the physical things they have are dwindled because they don't create new ones. They use what they have. Maybe the first few years is wonderful, but eventually it goes away. And then the economy in general that is produced by those elements that I just talked about continues to shrink. And it shrinks. And it shrinks. Every year, it shrinks at greater and greater levels. Eventually, there is widespread, poverty. And instead of prosperity, people are impoverished. Both the people who used to be prosperous and those who were given some level of prosperity in the redistribution, they all become impoverished. The country then becomes poorer and poorer, and eventually the economy fails. A failure in the economy means that it doesn't produce enough goods and services to keep people healthy and well, and even in moderate terms, creative, with any significant level of meaning in their lives. As people's lives become less meaningful, they do even less in any of the things that would reduce forces. The forces get intolerable. The intolerability of forces means very bad health, bad health care. It means a lack of the necessities that allow people to not significantly suffer from environmental factors, including weather and shelter, even clothing. It reduces people to near animal levels and sometimes less than animal levels of living. And it causes, in the longest term period, the eventual enslavement of everyone except for an elite small group who, behind the scenes, are robbing the system to keep themselves in some type of pseudo-prosperity, because eventually the system will come back and destroy them in the most ruthless of ways. It may take a few generations, but eventually that's the inevitable outcome, because the forces rise in those who are selfish, and it will eventually be a destruction. Communism has somewhere between an 80 and 120 year life expectancy under the best of circumstances, and about half of that in the worst. So you'd say 40 to 60 years in the worst. It all depends on how fast it's employed. Now, you can modify the typical communism in which you create an artificial class of prosperity. Now, what is artificial class? An artificial class of prosperity is letting people grow to a certain point of prosperity and then preventing any further growth so that people can, so to speak, like, have some level of wealth. But beyond that, then it's sucked in by the government. Some of it gets redistributed, and a lot of it goes corruptly to the people in the government. So that methodology, which is presently employed in places like China, has a little longer period before it fails, probably about 50% or so. It will fail for the same reasons, but since you're mitigating the forces to some extent, playing around with the amount of force, you can't prevent it from eventually going over, but you can slow it down through this methodology. And the reason it doesn't work overall is because even though there's some level of loud of creativity, the level of consciousness or love is never possible, because if that really took place, then the whole system would be freer, and the people trying to run and control the situation would lose control, so they don't let that happen. And so there is a definite ceiling to the levels both of freedom and consciousness, but the consciousness side, strangely, you would think it's the freedom side, but the consciousness side is the part that is most significantly restricted in those models. And when it happens, the eventual outcome is that the prevention of expansion of consciousness still leads to a lack of meaning in people's lives, even though they have a comfortable level of material living standards. And so they rebel anyway against the lack of meaning. And meaning is the bottom line, particularly as you go past the age of 30 or so. Life becomes more and more, well, say, based upon how much meaning someone has in their life, not based upon how much things they have. Also, on the emotive side, it kills the meaning from emotion, and kills, it wrecks the whole system of universal love, and it converts everything into some conditional love, which has a very superficial and eventually meaningless aspect as well. And of course, it always destroys ideas and the ability to think freely, because that's the most treacherous thing it fears by the government. It fears people thinking freely. So freedom of thought, they think, well, nobody's going to notice that you can't think freely. Yeah. But eventually that becomes an undermining that they can't stand. So it's surprising, the thing they have the least concern about is the thing that ultimately doesn't end. And there's very little that can be done to change this. It's inevitable that under these systems that destroy prosperity, there will be, in the long run, enslavement and eventually revolution. Speaking of revolution, I want to bring up something that is current, and that'll have to be in the next section. But I want to talk about what's happening in Egypt. I thought we would talk about that in relationship to prosperity tonight. We'll do that when we come back from the break, which is coming up right away here. And I want you to all think about this, that if your life were more prosperous, how would that change things for you, especially if you were to become more soul-like in the way you live? Think about that for the next couple of minutes. And also you can listen to the commercials as well. We will be back in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hon, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about principles of prosperity. And through the concepts of what would be considered to be ageless wisdom. Different than ancient wisdom, that's another vernacular for some other ideas, and different from what people sometimes refer to as just called metaphysics in general. Although certainly I'm open to thinking about and talking about those other ideas too. So at any rate, here's where we kind of left it off, and that is that when we have a system that has been tampered with by very selfish people, and if they exhibit or have great power over many other people, then the system inevitably goes bad. And this is especially true in terms of prosperity. If we're going to try to have a system of prosperity, there needs to be freedom, and the freedom needs to be in all levels, not just physical freedom. There needs to be emotive freedom, and there needs to be thought, mental thinking freedom. And there needs to be freedom of interaction between people. Now, when we look at some of the things that have happened, Egypt has come into the forefront in the last week or two. And it's been going on for months now that Morsi, the guy who became elected president of Egypt last fall, he decided to, within weeks of being elected, to suspend a good deal of the then constitution, change it around basically, get rid of most of the protections, including the protections of a court system that is free from political influence. He adopted and initiated many Sharia, that's Islamic, types of law. Now, not all Islamic people believe in Sharia law, but the ones that do have very strong feelings about it. But he initiated these things with the purpose of becoming a dictator. Not too different from Mubarak, who was the prior dictator, but worse. Why worse? Because Mubarak was only trying to gain power and control, not to change the minds and feelings of people, but just to gain material wealth. I think he's worth a couple billion dollars, because he skimmed that off of money mostly given to him by the United States. And these kinds of things. Of course, he's dead now, but the point is that his family and whatever, they went out to get. But if you look at the whole process, you see how this thing turned out. The idea of democracy has to have within it a process of protection of the minority interests and minority rights. When you have democracy that's strictly ruled by the majority, and then without there being protections of the minorities, then you have a dictatorship, even though that person was at least once elected by a election. Now, why did this go wrong? How did it go wrong? Because the constitution that was originally adopted was, it didn't have the rule of law behind it. And it allowed the president to just simply destroy it. Now, destruction of a constitution is destruction of ideation. It's the reduction of mental plain thought into emotive and physical interactions and, I will call it, forceful outcomes. And it prevents free thinking first, and then it prevents free feelings, and then eventually prevents free interactions. So it kind of goes in that order. And Morsi did this very quickly, actually more quickly than most, because he was the head in Egypt of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood basically are very communistic in their thinking when it helps them. But mostly they're Islamic extremists and an offshoot of the Al-Qaeda group, or vice versa, some people would argue. Now, how does this pan out then? What could be done better in the present situation, and how does prosperity fit into it? Well, the interesting thing, if you look from October till today, from last October, the economy in Egypt slipped to almost half of what it was before that. Not that it was all that great for the last couple of years in Mubarak, because of this sudden shift in loss of freedom and the almost immediate destruction in a consciousness of exchange between people that would be unsolo. Everything was selfishly done for the, we'll say, implementation of Sharia law over everybody. And with this type of tyranny, almost immediately prosperity dwindles. And here is an example. In a very short period of time, that one half of the economy, this is an approximate number, and this is an estimate, in Egypt just went down the tubes. And that's an example of extreme force when applied. Now, how is it that the people got rid of this Morsi guy so fast? Because usually these guys get embedded and it's almost impossible to get them out. Well, the interesting part is that he went against one of the basic principles, even in communism, and that is that you never tamper with the economy more than a small amount. Increasingly so, they do, per year, or else you end up with a revolution. And the communists are not good at withstanding revolutions. I know that sounds strange. They come into existence oftentimes from a revolution, but they're very bad. They don't withstand revolution very well, because they have no foundation in their ideation, which is virtue. There's no light in them. So they're kind of like paper tigers when faced with millions of people who say, you know what, we want you out now. And that's exactly what took place. That's a good thing. Here in the United States, our Constitution has been eroded significantly in the last 4.5 years by the president and administration, because they basically are socialist and communists, but they do it in a slower way, but they're still doing the same thing. The end product will be pretty much the same thing. The economy will eventually fail, but we'll go up and down more than we'll just go straight down, because we have still the, at least on the surface, the appearance of a free market. But very quickly that's going to change with a couple of changes in the healthcare issues and a couple other ways that regulations are being applied by the administrative part of the government, the executive part of the government. And so within a few years, that will be gone. And we could be facing a similar kind of, we'll call it, revolution of sorts. I don't think it'll be a violent one, but it may be something significant in either case. The important thing to remember here is that these types of thinking that redistribute and or corruptly steal, I think that Morrissey was corruptly stealing as much as he was redistributing, but he was doing redistribution to the Islamists. If you look at what his attempts were, it was to elevate the prosperity of the people who were Sharia Islamists and to destroy the Coptic Christians and anybody else. And he was trying to even drive them out of the Coptic Christians out of the country and take over all their wealth if he could. He would let them go, but with nothing. And so there was that going on. And also the enslavement was taking place, and the inability to have free expression. He took over the TV, the radio, you know, all the news and stuff. But all of that aside, if we look at the bottom line with Egypt, I think it's a good sign that one of the big posters in the last couple of days, right before he lost his position, has been "Wake Up America, Obama supports fascism here in Egypt, of course." And that poster to me says more about the it says a lot about both countries. It says a great deal about the Egyptians, and maybe even more about America, because it's so true. We're really, the majority of people in America don't understand what the foreign policy is of the United States and what it's really doing. It's supporting radical Islamists, and it's supporting a caliphate, and it's supporting the entire process is supporting, actually it's a caliphate, and the entire process is in removing effectively the safeguards so that the eventual destruction of the only free country in a true free country in the Middle East, which would be Israel, will be destroyed. And the most important thing is the caliphate will become one nation, in effect, under Sharia law, and will become the beginning of the end of the United States. I know it sounds weird, but it's true. There's a huge amount of things. But the good news is we discovered a lot of oil and gas that we can get to now through fracturing and fracking and doing things to various rocks and stuff, getting it out. And so we're going to become less dependent on, or we are, the Middle East in terms of oil. That's an economic, you know, jab against what has been taking place. Although the EPA is trying to stop that, and it may be able to in the next year. And then there's another thing that has to be looked at here. The process of change is towards a worldwide dictatorship, with possibly the United Nations being some kind of fake governing institution, but really it's going to be various dictators controlling the whole world. And probably the leader of what was or is the United States becoming leader of the world. So think about that. In terms of where we're moving towards. Now, I realize this sounds totally crazy. To people, especially 10 years ago, it would have sounded absolutely crazy. But if we were to wake up, I think we would discover most of what I'm saying, most people would discover it to be true. The difference is that we're asleep. And I love what they said. The Egyptians said, wake up, America. Because you have to really start seeing there's a design behind what's going on. It's not just by accident. It's not because the administration and the president are just incompetent. It's because they are genius-level dictators. And that's a whole different thing. They're way above the consciousness in dictatorship and in use of power than have been others. And that's the frightening thing about it, is that they are smart. And they're smart in an evil, genius way. And the real evil here is in keeping people asleep, making sure that nobody becomes conscious enough to recognize it, who could do something to stop it, and the people who do recognize it, you marginalize, diminish, destroy, maybe get their names and do something bad to them kind of thing, prevent them from being effective voting blocks or whatever by sending them IRS letters or preventing them from being able to assemble, whatever. You do whatever is necessary because nobody's stopping you. Nobody's awake. Even our Congress people are doing it. So prosperity means that you have to be conscious enough to keep it. You remember I said that everybody thinks it's freedom. If you've got enough freedom, you'll keep prosperity. But if you're not conscious enough, the dark side, particularly evil people, will still do you in. They'll still do you in. I know that seems unreasonable to some people. And it's unfortunate that that is the truth, in my opinion, because when you lose consciousness in a society, no matter how much they initially were free, they'll lose that too over time. So we all want to develop a higher consciousness. We have to become universally more loving. Or whatever prosperity we have, we're doomed to lose. We will become enslaved eventually by evil. And evil certainly will grow and not get less while people lose their consciousness. So I really want to focus on this. The two do need to be balanced. And you can't compensate for one with the other. You can't say, well, I'm going to be a lot freer. I'll just get so much money, I'll build my little castle somewhere, and everybody will be protected. It won't work. You've got to match it with the universal soul level of giving, so you help everybody else to become more conscious, more free, more creative. And then it works. If you don't do that, prosperity eventually is doomed, especially here in the physical world. It is true in the astral and mental, too, but we'll get to those. I want to make sure that we really got this covered for the physical world, because this is where we all are living right now, right? So if we don't get it here, learning about it afterwards, when you get to the astral world, it's a little bit late. And that's too late for me anyway, because I don't want to see this world go down the tubes. And we're marching in that direction at the present time. All right, so if we're going to achieve these wonderful elements of prosperity, we've got to balance our creations with the level that we help other people to become creative, and that we give to them in ways so they can do the same, and that everybody enjoys a consciousness level that protects their level of prosperity. Because remember, lower conscious people can't hold on to prosperity. They lose it. No matter what you give to them, they will lose it. From what I stated earlier in the show. And there's no way around that. You can't, like, you can slow it down like the Red Chinese are doing. But inevitably, it will happen. And it's a terrible consequence. And remember, the forces are so terrible here in the physical world that once they start rolling downhill, so to speak, you really can't stop it. Health is a big issue. And right now we're facing a terrible, terrible, well, here in the United States, with what will become single-payer, government-controlled health care. Oh, I know you were promised that wasn't going to happen. They're just going to help all the other insurance companies, besides the government. The government has to come in occasionally and insure some people. They're going to help all the other insurance companies be more competitive. That's what you heard, right? Within 5 years from the time that the government mandate kicks in, which now has been delayed a year, there will be no more. There will be no more insurance companies. There will just be the government. Everybody's going to be covered by the government, and that's the hope and goal, because everybody's going to get sicker faster, and then the process becomes a great power control issue. And I guess all of our health records are already being collected, and those will be used against people in many different ways. So the process is already in place, and health goes down the tubes anyway when you lose prosperity. Prosperity's going down. Oh, I know things got better a little bit in the last few months, economically speaking, depending upon who's doing the math and who's figuring out what's going on. Of course, you're going to have more people working if people are holding two jobs, because they're all, both jobs are part-time. One's maybe 25 hours a week and the other one's maybe 30. And so they're working a lot of hours. They're making less money per hour. But it looks like there's more people working because more jobs have been filled. They don't count the differences. They only count the total number. And so nobody sees what's really happening. Why did so many people take part-time jobs? Because they couldn't find full ones, and because the mandate from healthcare, which has been delayed now for a year as of this week, is forcing employers that have more than 50 employees to turn the rest of their employees into part-time people if they can afford to do that. And if they can't, then they're really stuck. Some of them are willing to pay $2,500 a year per person to have them go on government health care, but the government health care costs $7,500 a year, so the net loss of $5,000. Tell me how that works. You do the math. Okay, so the system is designed to bankrupt the United States, and we're moving in that direction. Bankruptcy leads to the ending of prosperity. You can't be prosperous. The country you live in is bankrupt. The first thing is that the money becomes worthless. So two things. Either there's a lack of goods and services you can buy. That's part of the problem. Most of the time, there's a inflationary issue where the money becomes no longer worth what it was. So you don't end up being able to purchase much with the money that you think you have. Now, I know some people are buying gold and all that business, but most people aren't. All right, so you have a lack of, we'll call it a future, when bankruptcy is in the wings. And how do we know it's in the wings? Because we're within a few years, about 5 years, of not being able to pay our bills. We're borrowing money today to pay them, but that there's an end to it. That's a game of the government being in the con game. They're printing more and more useless money. It hasn't caught up with it yet, with us yet, because we're forcing the rest of the world to pay for it first. That's odd. It has to do with the fact that our currency is held as the standard. So we steal from other countries as long as people assume our currency is stable. That won't last much longer. But it's an illusion, and you can get away with it for 5 to 10 years, and we've been doing it for 5. So it's a real serious problem, and there really isn't much of a way out. We don't have the time to get out of it by simply raising taxes. You can't do that. And the economy is not growing in any way near fast enough to do it here. The only way it could be done is to cut the expenditures. But the present administration is doing the reverse. And you might ask yourself, why is that? Well, I'll get some more votes, because most of the money goes to buy services and goods for people who don't deserve it. It's a redistribution concept. But it also gets to the thing they really need, which is for the government to bankrupt the country, and then there's all the power becomes focused into the progressive government that seeks that. Now, if we're going to deal with principles of prosperity from a metaphysical standpoint, we cannot get caught in the idea that this is just about having things, goods and services. It's about having the ability to have a meaningful life. Meaning comes from finding God. Ultimately, if you read Life's Hidden Meaning, you'll see that that's true. I don't have the time tonight to explain why that's true. It takes considerable lengths of time to explain how it all fits together. Now, let's assume for right now that there's some validity to that idea. So the meaning in life ultimately comes from finding God, and each person finds it uniquely, individually for themselves, by becoming individually, as a soul, part of God, and co-creating with that creator. When you do that, your meaning in life enormously goes up. But you have to have prosperity to some level to achieve it. Unless you're a saint and are willing to go through tremendous suffering to deal with the forces, or are some coming out there will say, seriously sacrificial person. There are very few people like that in the world. And it doesn't work that most people are like that. You can have a few, and those people can survive under the basis that they only function in a purely spiritual context. For most of us, it doesn't work, and it shouldn't work, because we're not in this world just to be focused only in spirit. We're in this world to balance spirit with form. And so we have, in general, a need to create prosperity, and not give it up. The prosperity we create needs to come from this balance between creation, purpose, will, choice, and consciousness, universal love, inclusiveness, planning. These are the kinds of things that, if we do this well, we will achieve incredible results. And we will do it by becoming closer to our co-creator, and be a co-creator. And we'll produce, amazingly, huge amounts of prosperity, not just in ourselves and for ourselves, but for all those we have any contact with whatsoever, even some that we don't have direct contact with, but we affect. This is the wonderment of life as it could be and should be. And in order to deal with this, in order to have this, for some of us, it may not be be possible to live in a country like the United States is becoming. Where you go, I don't know for sure, but if things get real bad here, it may not be possible. That may make it more and more difficult to even incarnate over and over again into this world. For some people, it just won't be possible. They can't exist as a soul here. And once you can't exist as a soul, if you are a spiritual being, if you're more soul-like, you have to move on. That leads to a very downward spiral within a century or two, the planet could end. Because there's not enough people who are spiritual, that are spiritually disciplining themselves, who could do most of the world's creation as it is, that are incarnate. And in a few generations, the whole thing falls apart. Now, why is it that spiritual disciplined people become most prosperous in the long run? And why is it their life is most meaningful? Because they are co-creating with God and creating light, and they're most creative because their creation is continuous and consistent, and they overcome any obstacles from forces, and they almost always succeed in some way. It may not be the way they originally intended. Their original creation might turn into 10 different other things. But ultimately, it leads to greater light in the world, and that's what they're really here for. And that's the big difference. Unfortunately, we live in a system that was designed in this particular world, and I want you to understand this is unique almost to Earth, that involves the very fewest being the most creative and conscious people. Most planets don't go through that method. It's called spiritual discipleship through initiation. And it is, it's not used in most worlds, because it requires too much from too few, and the chance of failure is great. It is the fastest method that, if done successfully, that a planet could grow, because you're taking, you're standing on the shoulders of only a few who are doing so much for you. They're doing the heavy lifting. But when those few thin out too far, the whole thing collapses. And that's the danger. The advantage is that it could save time by 9/10. A huge amount of time could be saved in the development of a planet if you can use the system and be successful. Earth is one of the few planets that is trying the system. Some planets have succeeded with it, and many more have failed. Why would we choose that? What's so important about Earth? Earth is working on a specific problem, a new kind of monastic or mental evil that is being developed, not even in this galaxy. And this evil needs some experimental laboratories, planets, that are going to try to overcome it. And the reason it's needed that things happen so fast on these planets is because the monastic evil itself is much faster in the way that it spreads and develops. What it can do in a few generations would normally have taken millennia in the past, or maybe tens of thousands of years in the past, in Earth time. So there's a need for something else to help give a boost, and in this case, one of the things it's boosting is initiation through spiritual discipleship, and that's what's being tried here, because it's hoped that that will succeed and beat this evil. If we fail, then there's other methods that are being employed in other places, and those may succeed there. But someone needs to succeed, because eventually, although maybe sometime in the future, this type of evil will spread out throughout the universe, and it would be a very bad thing if it were to catch on and be successful in a lot of places. So Earth is an experiment. We're using one of the more failure-oriented methods that relies on too much from too few, too fast. Okay. And for those of you who consider yourselves spiritual disciples, if that's what you're into, be aware that your chances of success are not as strong as if you were doing some similar activities in a less evil world, or if some of the other methodologies were used than pure spiritual discipleship and initiation. There are a whole slew of, we'll call them, offshoots that are not as radical, where the spiritual discipleship is watered down to some extent, but more people participate. The process is much slower, but because there is not mental evil that's trying to take over that particular world, it can be used there with some significant levels of success, and it is used that way. But remember, here, that's not true. Earth was not chosen by God, so to speak, to become inundated by evil. Evil chose Earth. So this is a weird thing. And you could say, well, how come that happened? Well, if you go back in time, before there was Earth, there was a kind of predecessor planet in another solar system, but it was really the first incarnation of the sun that we're familiar with. And that star didn't last long, like 10 million years max. And people only existed in etheric form, never in dense physical form. That planet was inundated with a more forceful, less monastic evil, but it was so quickly destroyed and so ferociously done that it became clear that the next incarnation would be a big attack by evil on the planet Earth, and it was known to be coming from that. So the plan was to then allow this new system to be attempted. And if spiritual disciples do all the things that they can do, they would become the most prosperous people. In the past, if we go back historically, the people who were spiritual disciples before the last 2 centuries almost always became prosperous. Not everyone, but most of them did. And they, let's take the founders of the United States. They were almost all of them were spiritual disciples. Some of them even were members of the same spiritual group. And not all of them, about maybe a fifth or a second spiritual group. That was a Freemason group that was founded in part in the original, what we call colonies. And these folks were basically, and some people used to call them, all those are the Sons of Liberty, aren't they? Well, maybe they call themselves that. But this particular group of people, by and large, were prosperous. Now, why were they prosperous so uniformly? And the answer is that there were less forces because there was less mental evil that they had to contend with. So they could make some mistakes and get by with them. And the biggest mistake they made was sometimes not sharing enough of their prosperity, especially those that had slaves. That was a very big issue for them. And in other circumstances, those who were still not slave owners, they were not as magnanimous and universally giving as they could have been to help others to do so. Some were well known to do that. Others were more stingy and therefore more personally selfish with their prosperity. But in either case, they all had some element, I should say most all of them, had some element of prosperity. That was a big part of who and what they were doing because it was a bit easier for them then. Harder today from the standpoint that the conflicting elements for a spiritual disciple leads him into a more direct, conflictive approach coming from evil on a monastic level. Let's take Egypt again and look at that from the standpoint of what's happening there. There's some spiritual disciples running the movement for freedom in Egypt. That was stolen from them by the Islamists at the end of the summer last year. And so they were supplanted by extreme Islamists when they were trying to gain a free and open society, free from dictators, and freedom to think and create. And these people were somewhat prosperous, some of them, but most of them were unable to gain the level of prosperity because the corruption in the government was sucking a lot of it out of the ability for them to do so. That was the prior dictator. He was pulling it out. I'll get it out later. And he was doing that in a sense to keep them controlled. But also they were too young. Some of them were not yet even mature disciples. Usually that's considered like age 28. Many of them were barely 21. And so you have a circumstance where the nature of the way Egypt was set up made it difficult for them to become as prosperous as the people that created, say, some of the great ideas and freedoms in the United States. Some of it was just chronological age. Some of it was based upon a different system. The system itself, economically, required, if you're going to be truly prosperous, truly wealthy, you had to participate in a lot of corruption with the government, and that wasn't what was happening in the United States, but it was what was happening in Egypt, and that short-circuited a lot of the potential. Now, if you don't have prosperity, you can't withstand the forces that the Islamists put on these people last summer, a year ago, and pushed them out, basically. So that force was gradually employed for the whole year before. It was just gradually intensified, until they were removed from what was taking place. And suddenly they woke up one day and they realized they went from the frying pan into the fire. They went from a dictator who was corrupt to a dictator who was corrupt and an extremist, communist, Islamist who wanted to be destructive to all those who didn't think and act the way they did. Ooh. Very bad dictator to have running around. So that's what was going on in that respect. And that's how they ended up in the mess that they're in. And we're still dealing with this now. You see, if the United States and some other countries don't come in and help to settle this corruption issue and at the same time resolve the problems that these people, again, who are trying to take control back into the people, so to speak, it'll just be a replay, maybe with a worse outcome. So there could be a civil war. So we have to do something, but unfortunately, the leader of our country, the United States, is not on the side of those people seeking freedom. And I want you to think very seriously about that. Okay, the hearers then see that spiritual disciples have to have some level of prosperity, or they won't succeed, even though their ideation is right, even though they're doing some things correctly. They have to be able to balance between their creativity and their givingness if they become too, we're called, mental in their focus. We're going to get to that. The physical world can't slip away from them in terms of its own importance, and they may fail to realize that despite all the things that they're saying and doing, which are great things, and they're sentiment isn't a great place, emotively. They don't and haven't developed enough prosperity to be able to deal with the forces that they're eventually going to have to deal with. And that's where these folks find themselves right now. I wonder if the population in the United States, if some people, maybe someone who's listening to me right now, say, let's get together and have a support the spiritual disciple movement going on in Egypt. The young people who are basically idealists, more mental than they are material, help them to realize they need to have some wealth behind them in order to support themselves against the forces that inevitably will be coming at them. And if they don't, they're probably going to end up in a civil war where they may get killed. So we get to look at this from a very serious problem. And we're right in the crux of it right now. This is next few weeks, you know, probably tell us what direction things are moving. Okay, let's move on, because we've covered what I wanted to cover for the physical world for right now. Because there's more to the subject, but this is good enough. And let's talk about the astral world. Prosperity in the astral world is very different, because the quantum constant changes. And force becomes less and less of an issue, since the thought of a person overcomes force much more easily. And that thought is creative imagination in the astral world. So as long as somebody has the right creative imagination, they could create anything they want, and other people can have only a minimal amount of effect on them. Some effect, yes. But that effect is mostly in the 5th, 6th, and 7th subworlds. It almost non-existent above that in terms of consciousness. In those subworlds, you will find that the folks exhibit considerable amounts of creative imagination interference with other people that live in. You can still avoid it to some extent, but it's harder and harder as you go in lower consciousness areas. Even within each subworld, there are some areas that are a bit more conscious than others, some that are less destructive to prosperity. What does it mean to be prosperous? It means that with your creative imagination, you can create whatever you want that will be helpful towards the development of being imaginative, more imaginative, and more empathic over time, to eventually become spiritually empathic or super empathic, so that you can understand how everyone around you and everything is feeling. And you are completely aware of your own feelings at the same time. This gives you a tremendous ability to interrelate with people in profound ways. It makes life meaningful in the astral sense, because God in this realm is about love. And if your life isn't filled with universal love, if it's conditional, you'll be lacking in meaning. And if you don't even have conditional love, your life will be very, very miserable, because you'll have a meaningless life in the astral. So here, we'll say prosperity is still dependent upon being creative in your imagination. It's still dependent upon giving elements of creative imagination to others based upon your super empathy to help them become more godlike in the way that they co-create and produce everything that we consider to be a form or of form in the astral world. The entire astral world is created by creative imagination. This is hard for us to understand, because we think of things as being really there, you know. The only place things are really there is in the dense physical. Everything else is created more obviously by thought. Things are created here by thought too, but we can't notice it. It's just too slow. In the astral world, it's thousands thousands of times faster, and the results are pretty dramatic. Okay, so then what is prosperity? It means that one can create with their creative imagination, and one can give it empathically to others, help them to do the same, better for themselves, and help them to improve their senses in ways that represents things that are virtuous, godly. The creations themselves help people to be closer to God. Or, if you're really into desires and saturating those, then you do it not for God's purpose, but for stimulation of your astral body, and possibly for the astral bodies of others. Those kinds of creations are transient. They don't last very long because things are so easily changed by other people. And if you create things like that, they can't survive. If you create things that are virtuous, they are very resistant to the selfish imagination of others, especially in the higher subworlds. If you do it in the lowest, like the seventh subworld, someone can overcome and destroy it or move it around a bit, but it's not easy for them to do so, and they'll wear out their senses quite a bit. If you, as a spiritual person, created something wondrous, they would have a hard time making it destroy. If they did, they'd be using up a lot of who they are, which would end their life fairly quickly and make their life meaningless at the same time. So prosperity is more resistant to being destroyed by darkness in the astral worlds, subworlds, and it is a true, we'll call it, exchange of people's thought towards and with each other, and their feelings at the same time. So thought and feelings become, in this case, imagination and love, or the lack of it, become the exchange of what we'll call monetary standards. There's no need for there being a physical exchange of money, although they do have ways of exchanging sense, which is bizarre. So you could collect and exchange senses in some of the lower subworlds, but that's a whole other thing. As far as money is concerned, it's kind of, you can't represent time and energy with money because it becomes wrapped up with thought so easily and with love, the direction that your thought is moving. So the direction of your thought, of your creative imagination, is the real bottom line to whether or not you're going to be prosperous or not. And people learn within a few dozen years, in almost all circumstances, people learn that if you want to be prosperous, you have to be more loving in your imaginative thought and serve others as well. There also is mental thought that can be employed there, and people do employ it. But, and that adds to the creative imagination. It isn't as profound in the astral world because mental thought still has a lot of trouble changing astral form. It still takes a huge amount of mental thought to do much in the astral world, whereas creative imagination can get things done very rapidly. But the advantage of mental thought has is that it lasts a lot longer because it deals with the future. Whereas creative imagination doesn't last as long because it deals with an immediate point in time and space, and as things change over years of time in the astral world, that level of the creative imagination may have been terrific at the time, but gradually diminished in value as other people's creative imagination has moved in a different direction. Mental thought doesn't do that because it's held together by a thing called truth. And it deals with the future. So it considers the future in what it creates. And that has a much longer life to it. Okay, so those who are prosperous have great creative imaginations. And they use it in a direction that helps others to do the same. they can act as souls much more easily. So it's a more spiritual place to go to. Even the lower astral subworlds, in many cases, are more spiritual than most parts of the physical world. Physical world is all smushed together. So you don't have different subworlds. Oh, there's the etheric parts, but that doesn't count. And it's all smushed together, and you have people of all kinds of consciousness living together. In the astral subworlds, for the most part, the people live separate. Those of different levels of consciousness live at different parts of the subworld, of the astral world. And they create differently. They create, again, with more forces and with less definiteness in terms of succeeding to be prosperous and succeeding to exist in the lower subworlds. And as you move up in consciousness in the higher subworlds, those things that people create can last thousands and thousands of years. And that's astral years now. And there's little effort is employed in the creation of much of what is done. Those are good things. There is a slight penalty to paying, though, in the higher subworlds. When you can create something that lasts so long, because sometimes people become complacent, and they may not be as creative as they should be in improving upon that which has been already created in such a nice or beautiful way. This is particularly true in the fourth subworld. Seems like that is where the problem manifests itself the most. People create wonderful things, great things, but they don't tinker with them to improve them very much once everybody is happy with it. Oh, that's nice. It works great. Why worry? Why change? Let's leave them alone. This lack of, we'll call it, the urge to be more creative, is partly also comes from each person wanting to create a completely different way and not improve or change those things that people have already created themselves. So there's a lack of improvement in many areas. There's some unique things that are created, but sometimes they're not all that impressive because each person is creating for the wrong purpose. Hypocritically, they're trying to create because they want to look like they are, in some way, a whole lot, you know, more spiritual or whatever. I mean, that could be about. Now, tell me that isn't pretty strange. Just want to be more spiritual, and they're going to go ahead and do what the heck they want to do in order to be whatever they want to be. And so you reach a point where it isn't always true, where how people appear to others is more important than whether or not they're really creating anything that's of any value, and they don't want to mess with anything anybody else has created because they won't get that much credit for it anyway. That's the fourth subworld, which is a wacko place because many of people actually want to be spiritual. The wants, the wannabes are not necessarily the people who are being so. So that's kind of a weird thing that goes on there. Not everybody's like that. It vacillates from one to the other, and it's not always the case. Okay, so that happens on occasion. When it does, you know, it doesn't provide the most meaningful life. Because the things people are creating aren't significant, and the things that could be significant they don't want to mess with because somebody else already created it, and why monkey with that, they probably didn't get credit for it. And that's a big problem. But people live through it, and they eventually overcome it, or they become a victim of it. And the weird thing is, they lose prosperity. As time goes by, they may live a very, opulent life. They may have everything they ever wanted in any sense of the word, but because they keep using their creative imagination in a more self-focused way, they start losing their senses. Their empathy diminishes, and they can't really create anything that is true lovingness. So the things they do create tend to fall apart more easily. They start aging. They start falling apart in terms of their physicalness, we'll call it that. Anyway, they're not physical, but their appearance. And they lose the perspective, or we'll put it another way, they lose the incentive to become something more meaningful, and then they get depressed. More often than just about any place that I know about in the astral world, in the fourth subworld, after a few hundred years of living there, people get depressed. They actually don't find life very meaningful, even though they have this wonderful everything. And as they get depressed, and as they lose all these other things, their prosperity diminishes. And instead of living an opulent life, they sometimes live a more meager life. And eventually find it difficult to deal even with the relatively meager forces that are existent in the fourth astral subworld. And the forces start taking a toll on them. They actually get astral diseases that are the result of these forces diminishing their senses and their bodies. Their body, their astral body. Strange, strange place. Okay. Some people don't necessarily suffer that. Some people go through spiritual discipleship there. They do wonderfully. They even move on to higher subworlds. I mean, there's a mixed bag. And then in the third astral subworld, when you look at it from the perspective, remember, these are segregated worlds because the creative imagination is more affected by the changes, giant changes in quantum constant between each different subworld. And so as that is changed, then the whole world changes because people's creation becomes greater and their consciousness grows, etc. But to get there is hard, because you got to initially have the consciousness to even stay awake in these higher subworlds. People in the third subworld, they want to create new things. They're kind of like the antithesis of the people before. They want to constantly create something. And they don't want to just create what other people have created, but they create new things that are sometimes unique, and they work together to create things, which is interesting, because they don't do that too much in the fourth subworld. And they go back and they look at mistakes and see where the problems have happened, and they recreate things that are no longer applicable. And then they share these things with people in the lower subworlds, much more than people in the fourth subworld do. And so they're more spiritual. They may not appear that way because they don't try to look more spiritual in an emotive sense. But they do have a strong, we'll call it maniacic or mental inclinations. And so a lot of the creations they do includes a more mental side to it. Finally, the mental side of creating things becomes almost as important as the astral. So it doesn't just, they don't just create things to make people feel better. They create things because they are better, mentally speaking. They apply more truth to life. This is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with it. And those people that do that become very prosperous. So during most of their lifetime, majority of their lifetime, people are very prosperous in the third mental world, and they don't really lose their prosperity until they can't participate in the creative levels that others are co-creating in, because their senses diminish over time, because they aren't spiritually disciplining themselves enough. So although the people in the third subworld, by and large, are more conscious and more prosperous, they eventually lose their prosperity because they're not spiritually disciplining themselves. Remember, that's the keynote of Earth. Eventually, even if you're in a third subworld, if you're not going to live a spiritual life, your prosperity will suffer and you'll lose it. Now, why is it so important? Well, because you can go on and live another 500 years or longer in the mental world, in the third astral subworld, excuse me. But you'll be kind of ostracized and be unable to function for most of that time in the active life of the people who have a younger set of senses and haven't destroyed them as much. Or those who are spiritual, more, we'll say, spiritually disciplined. if you become spiritually disciplined, then you can live anywhere in the third subworld, and you can serve there, or you can serve the lower worlds, and occasionally you may be able to go to one of the spiritual higher subworlds, the second universe. If you do all that, then your prosperity never gets diminished. Not unless you choose to give it up for some very specific reasons of sacrifice. The interesting element here is that it's all based upon how people feel, and then secondarily, as they think, except in the third subworld, the thought is taking precedence some of the time. Truth is very important to them, unlike any place else in the lower subworlds. And it's a fascinating oddity. It's different than any place else, either in the physical world or in the lower subworlds of the astral world. And it's interesting to see how prosperity is following the same conscious issues, the same principles that I have talked about in this show. It's amazing that these principles apply everywhere that I know about, which is the three worlds that human beings exist in our universe. So it's amazing how the principles remain the same, but they have a different effect because the physics changes, and when physics change, everything changes with it, so you're getting different results, of course. That's part of the process. Fascinating. Amazing. And finally, we eventually get to the point where people are spiritual disciples, by and large, almost exclusively in the second and first subworlds of the astral world. There you have a different kind of prosperity. In the second subworld, so much of the prosperity is spent on helping other people to become conscious. One way or another, a huge amount of effort, even in the creation of things, is spent on consciousness. So there's a lot of education. Education becomes like a huge, big part of the second subworld. And they even have larger, more, we'll call a more expansive type of education than in the first subworld. Because the emphasis is on trying to raise the consciousness of everybody, trying to help people to have greater understanding of everything around them, and especially of God. And so God and understanding God is a huge, big part of living there. And the prosperity isn't not so much in what you have, although people live very nicely. It's not as opulent as some of the other places. It's more about people having access to greater and greater levels of understanding on a daily basis. So people are spending almost all of their creative imagination on expanding their understandings. Amazing stuff. There are parts of the second astral subworld where people actually could go to places to visit other worlds that are imagined and created in that subworld, so people can go and say, well, what would it be like to live someplace other than Earth? And you can actually experience those other places to some extent. Now, I had a very smithering of that because my consciousness was never quite high enough to stay there very long. But I can tell you it's an amazing element. And by the way, to preface what I just said, coming to astral traveling is so much harder to stay in a place than that you go to in the astral world than if you are needed there. Then your consciousness naturally lends itself to doing that. You got to really be working on your spiritual self to even get to the astral subworlds, much higher than especially the fifth. And especially to live in one of these exalted high places, almost impossible. Okay, so, back to what I was saying. So there's amazing kinds of experiences that people can enjoy and at the same time gain terrific understanding from. A lot of the stuff I teach, people can learn about in the second astral subworld, but directly through experience rather than from, you know, some just read it in the book, listen to this guy talk on the radio kind of stuff. I'm not belittling or saying it's worthless to do that, but it's way better if you can understand something by direct experience. And that's what the second subworld is all about. It's really, it's hallmark. It truly is. And the prosperity then is in terms of these kinds of experiences that people have. They have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of those kinds of experiences, and then they eventually take some of those experiences and see how they can improve upon the elements of things that are so, we'll say, esoteric for us to even get a handle on. Sometimes it's about what life is in other worlds and how that could be adapted to here. Sometimes it's about changing some of the ways that evil has infiltrated and is destroying the consciousness of people while in the physical world or the lowest parts of the astral subworld. Sometimes it's about just people learning how to be as ultimately soul-like in a truly occult, empathic and loving way that anybody could possibly be. In other words, attempting to live that kind of life in the world that is focused most on it. That doesn't mean that you can't understand it better in some ways mentally in the astral world, but you can experience the feelings of it unless you're in the astral world. So the mental world cannot replace the astral world in terms of the prosperity of living a loving life that is directly experienced by all those around you. This is a little hard for us to understand from our perspective because we don't really know what this is like. There just is no such place here in physical Earth at the present time. You would literally have to go to another physical world where there virtually is no evil for this to manifest itself and for people to understand what I'm saying. And at any rate, so this is the second subworld, and I better move on because we won't get through this show otherwise. And so when people, some people are able to live in the first astral subworld. What's the difference? Because they're both spiritual places. The first astral subworld emphasizes creativity and the ability to help people to govern themselves within a collective. You notice I've said within, govern themselves within a collective, not be governed. This is a totally different kind of ideation than what we presently have in Earth, on Earth, physical Earth. Here we think of governance as some body of people having control over the rest of us that we somehow allow them to do. This first astral subworld is totally the opposite of that. I'll try to put it in perspective. Those who are prosperous there have the most ability to govern themselves so that it benefits others to help them govern themselves as well. It also has the most benefit, therefore, in helping themselves to be most creative without interfering with the creativity of others. And that's what they work on there. If you're prosperous there, you're able to create enormously amazing things, but your creativity in equal measure does not interfere with the creation of all your compatriots who live in the same subworld with you. And then you use pieces of that to help people in all the lower subworld, the second through the seventh, to learn little bits of that, as well as to help the governing bodies that work more traditionally the way we're used to here, to be less governing bodies and more to help people to become free. It's not so easy to do. The creative part is not hard. You can be creative without much difficulty because people are super, super imaginative, amazingly empathic, so they can do just about anything. And their minds are so strong that they can really, with the astral matter around them, it's such a highly refined energy. You can make it into almost anything. But the problem is, because of that, it's easy to interfere with other people. So the real trick is doing all that and at the same time having super empathy to the point where nothing you do does anything other than help others become more creative rather than to be less. A real big deal. The people in the first astral subworld spent hundreds and hundreds of years mastering that thing that I just described. It's so amazing. And as they master it, they become more and more prosperous. How so? Their creations last forever because there are never any forces against their creations because they never interfere with anyone else and vice versa. They make things that are so permanently creative yet easily changed by anyone who can help make them better that it's the most creative place you can live in the astral subworld. And as far as emotive factors are concerned, it's the most loving place you can live in any place that a human being can exist. Wow. So being in the first astral subworld is a tremendously dynamic event that can really be meaningful. God becomes a part of everybody, and everybody becomes a part of God. It's like everybody's walking around being a super being that exists there and can live there in full consciousness all the time. There aren't that many people who live in the first astral subworld. It's a very small number relative to the rest of the place. Everybody there is a spiritual disciple, and all of them are, when they get there, are accepted spiritual disciples. What does accepted mean? It means that they're ready to proceed to the next level of initiation. They haven't yet necessarily done so, but they may do so while they're in the first astral subworld. And this is not uncommon. People that get there oftentimes move into the next initiation level there. They will have to replicate some of it when their next incarnation in the physical world, but they will quickly reestablish their level of new initiation. When I say quickly, I mean within usually the first 28 years of their life. So it's so amazing that people in this place are prosperous from being able to create anything and everything that is godlike. They live in a world that represents emotively God. And their feelings are constantly one of joy and bliss. A wonderful place to live, to say the least. The same principles apply to prosperity, but in this subworld, almost nobody loses their prosperity. Almost no one. I mean, there are some exceptions. Some people do fail this way, that way, whatever. But most of them don't. The vast majority do not. And it's a great place. Getting there is the tough part. Because to stay conscious in this world, you can't screw up. When you screw up, you lose the ability for your consciousness to create your own body long enough to stay there. And then you just go down to the second subworld, usually. But the point is that and people in the second subworld sometimes can get to the first for a few minutes, an hour or so. But they can't maintain it because they can't maintain that level of creation where it doesn't interfere with anyone else. As soon as it starts interfering, the forces come in. Their bodies are made of such refined energy that they quickly dissolve their bodies. They fall apart. And their senses don't maintain integrity. They can't really maintain consciousness. They fall asleep. Boom. They're back to the second subworld again. If you want to be kind of a consciousness yo-yo, you can do it a few times. And eventually you realize it's kind of senseless to keep doing it until you actually can maintain that level of consciousness for a significant period of time, hopefully forever. Once you get there, you would like to stay. That's the best way. Very difficult place to get to. Almost impossible to stay unless you're living in the astral world and not traveling there by some factor. So you gotta be definitely doing a lot of goodness in the world, a lot of creation of goodness in the world. And let's move on now and talk about the mental realm, because this is going to be even more difficult to try to fully comprehend what prosperity means in a mental sense. And if we're looking at this from a standpoint of how to achieve, we'll call it prosperity. Think of it this way. The commodity you're looking for in the mental world is truth, which is the light of the mental world. To get the truth, you've got to eliminate all elements of egotism, and you need to help everyone else that you can to do the same. And you need to do it in four separate ways, because this is the lower mental world where everything is constructed out of thought form. So the form of thought, which is an example of some concept. And your concepts need to be no less than spiritual in order to achieve any significant life. So in the mental world, there's no such thing as leading a selfish life, a non-spiritual life, and having much meaning in life, because you get caught in a thing called the mental akasha, which is like the past part of your own life experiences, which prevents you from developing enough sense to communicate and have contact with other residents of the subworld that you're in. There are four subworlds, the seventh, the sixth, the fifth, and the fourth. Those subworlds are all the places that thought forms can exist. And the form of thought has a lot to do with prosperity. So it's a form of thought, in the seventh subworld, the lowest subworld, where a lot of people eventually land, so to speak, when they first get to the mental world, is, and that's people who have died from the astral world. They go to this mental world, and the first thing that they discover is they're all alone. They can't communicate with virtually anybody except for some servers that exist there. Those are people who are willing to spend some of their time helping the newbies who get there to get over their egotism, and their solar angel, who represents a part of their soul. And these servers basically help a person to understand these constant experiences they're having in their own past. They keep going back to parts of their past that are connected by the same level of egotism or arrogance, depending upon the levels that they have, of their thinking in their past life. Sometimes it's even more than one lifetime before that, but most of the time it's their present past life. Both egotism they employed while they were physically alive, and also while they were astrally alive. They go back to these same experiences, and they relive them. They don't relive them to experience them. They relive them to change the way they are constructing their thought, so that others can think more clearly around them in these reconstructed experiences. The experiences for them are very real. They are as conscious as they were during the experience in the first place, but they aren't fully conscious because they may forget they're even in the middle world. They actually interact as if they're really there. It's almost like having a very, very vivid, lucid dream. They're semi-conscious. They may remember sort of that they're really in the middle world, but they can't integrate it in what's going on, and they're taken away by the events. They may go through the same experience hundreds of times, and it wears out their mental sense that they're dealing with. In this case, it'll deal with their, what is called the seventh sexual center in the mental sense. That's kind of a strange thing to talk about. But anyway, they're not really talking about sex. They're thinking about things that are very physical in form. It deals mostly with how they dealt with material form things and how they mentally lie to themselves and to others, dealing in some way with mental form. They could go through the same experience over and over because they don't change how they think. Therefore, they contaminate themselves, obviously, but all the people around them with their bad thoughts. And the object is to change it so that the mental load becomes clear and truth becomes part, or light becomes part of their life and everybody else's. It's shared. It kind of spreads out. So the prosperity is of having more truth in thought. As you have greater truth, you have more light in your thought. And what you gain from the prosperity is contact with other people. Eventually, over time, if you have enough contact with other people, the result is, hey, you're living a life not only in the Akasha, gradually that diminishes, your life becomes more and more interactive with a whole host of people that are fully awake and interactive in the mental world, because your sense becomes clear enough to be able to communicate. And all of the mental world, just like in the astral, is constructed from thought, but it's not constructed from astral thought because you don't have an astral body anymore. It's constructed only from mental thought. And it revolves around mental thought that is concrete or has form to it. It's an amazing place because things instantly can be recreated. Whole worlds can be created. Whole new futures of this world can be created. And people can live out scenarios of those futures to see how the world can be better served. It really helps people to grow very rapidly. In terms of, if you were talking about intelligence, it's a very hard thing to discuss here because this is a different world, but people are all, at least at the genius level that we think of as genius in this world. That's the minimum level people are at. Some are more brilliant than we can imagine and are interacting in this brilliance together, creating things that we can't even imagine. And some of these things become reality in their future life when they reincarnate into a different personality, though. And they'll forget what they did in the mental world to some extent, but little pieces of it will come back to them from time to time. And they may become recreative of it here. So some of the prosperity that they create in the mental world can be brought with them into the physical world if they are not egotistical here. That can come through. They get through their egotism here, or if they don't develop, they can use much of what they did in their last life in the mental world here. That's a good reason not to be egotistical, because your creativity goes vastly up, and your communication with others gets better, much better improved. And the truth you built here becomes huge. So the prosperity you grow in the mental world stays with you and comes back here. Now, I should have said that also, but the love you grow in the astral world stays with you to some extent, as better empathy when you reincarnate in the physical world. So there's a prosperity there that also stays with you. Your creative imagination will improve and stay. So you get that as well. These are very good things and well worth it to have and to cherish, actually. These are all graces of God, if you want to think about it. So if we want to continue now in looking at the mental world, that was just the most part deals with things that were in the physical world that are thought forms about material things for the most part that have more tangible kinds of application. In the sixth subworld, you deal more with thoughts that deal with effectively connections to emotive sensation and feelings, sometimes about physical things and sometimes just about feelings themselves. And the egotism associated with this is really what you're dealing with. What is truth in relation to how you feel and how other people feel, and what is truth about how you feel about even material things as well? So all of that combined is what people in the sixth subworld are dealing with. And those kinds of things have a lot to do with whether or not people have significant meaning in their life in a positive sense. If they don't have that significant meaning in a positive sense, what happens is they could correct a lot of the egotism about material things but their life still seems hollow. So the six subworld experiences, which almost everybody goes through, in the mental world, adds a lot of enrichment to a future life for a new incarnate. And this is so important because we have to look at it from the standpoint that if we don't make the changes there, the chances in the next lifetime of being very successful are quite limited, possibly even to the point where one almost becomes the predictor of the future. The soul knows this when you eventually go back to being your soul. If you don't succeed in the mental world, it could be a real problem. Much effort is made by everybody present in the mental world to try to help people get over their egotism so they have some mental life that's realistic, that's new, and that grows them further. That prosperity stays, and they want it to stay because as souls, they're developing back into their souls. They realize this is going to come back. They see themselves more as a unit. But each person is individually creating as well. And those individual elements, their creation, follow them. Finally, in the fifth subworld, you have a totally kind of different approach because this world really works on how mental creation and form is a, well, we'll call it in its own right, has its own significance. Now, how could that be? Because, you know, when you come back to reincarnate, you're not going to live in the mental world other than when you sleep. So how in the heck is it going to be so significant? And this is where the future comes in. Almost all elements of the creations for future things comes from the development in the prior life of a person's success in overcoming egotism in the fifth mental subworld. It's from that perspective that the future of the world becomes important. People don't just create things that are physically appropriate and helpful in the physical sense, but as it exists. Sometime in the near future, when they reincarnate, and they don't just create things that are just feeling good to them at that time either. They're creating for what it's going to be like even when they're gone, or maybe 20 years into their future. They become much more future-oriented, and that's why the fifth subworld becomes such an important place. Evil is trying to infiltrate the fifth subworld mentally, and if it succeeds in doing that, the egotism of people will not be curved, and they will have almost no mental life, and the future will become dim, and that's how evil wins. It's got to stamp out the hope, people call it hope, of humanity. And without the fifth subworld, the hope of humanity is lost. A terrible, terrible setback could take place. And the fight is in the mental world. Right now, it's hard to understand this because we think everything is so densely involved with evils. The evil wants to connect the fifth mental subworld with darkness. And it could do that by driving truth out of the fifth subworld. And that's what it's doing with the thing called propaganda. Some people call it spin these days. But that's the main thing, to get rid of the truth, drive it out. When you do that, you will drive out all future prosperity. And no matter how prosperous someone may become in their next lifetime, their future will lose it. And then evil will win. The last subworld that people live in is the fourth subworld, monastically speaking now. And in this subworld, the people try to bring together all elements of their next lifetime to try to recreate a future life as it would be in total, past, present, and future, so that all the elements develop truth, they all have unconditional love that is truly universal, and then they further have a beauty of sorts, we can call them beauty, to the physicality. So the material part of life only helps to serve the increase in sense in the people around them. It doesn't disrupt or destroy sense, and you end up with this almost perfect existence in the fourth subworld. Most people don't spend too many years there because by that point they're already virtually ready to join their souls. And in addition, their senses have been pushed to the limits in many cases, so they might only have a few decades of their time to live there, some a little longer, some shorter. But still, within that time, they experience an ideal future, one that truly is near perfect, and that incorporates in it all the elements of the three worlds that humans live in. So it incorporates the physical, the emotive, the feeling, astral world, and it incorporates the truth, mentally speaking, of concepts that are truly about God. This is the closest that human beings can come to experiencing God, because from that world they go on to rejoin their soul and consciousness. The personality either fuses with the soul or it is gone. It just disappears. Either way, what's left is the goodness and consciousness of the human never goes away. So the human never dies. In consciousness, the human goes back to being a soul, and it experiences its soul as a singular oneness to itself at that point. There's no difference. It's just like it suddenly wakes up and says, oh, I've always been a soul. Here I am back again with my soul. And the two become one. It isn't as though there's a separation any longer. As a soul, the human then decides, in almost all cases, to reincarnate. And it knows what the ideal is. It has experienced that in the fourth subworld. So its perspective is one of a prosperity of unity. Unity with its soul and unity with other souls, yet individuality within that unity that comes from unique creations that it can provide and share and work with all the other souls it's going to co-incarnate with. Those souls have chosen to do that together while they have always been souls in the higher middle world. They've been working together all the time while their incarnates as individual humans have been learning to become more soul-like in these lower worlds. The souls themselves can't imbue any prosperity from their perspective. They, on to the next incarnate, all they can do is help to create that incarnate in terms of spiritual genes that will match the physical genes and give certain characteristics to that new personality so that they have the best chance of overcoming prior karma, things they've done that are harmful to themselves and others, and at the same time that they will work together in the most harmonious way possible so that the best results are possible. No guarantee of anything. And again, what the soul is giving is the creation of the incarnate, but no direct thought. People think that the soul imbues, some people think the soul imbues some kind of direct thinking, like a stamp of its own way of thinking onto the human. That is not the case. The human actually creates its own life from its own thought. It has assistance when it seeks it from the soul through the soul or angel offload times, but it doesn't have direct impression. The reason for this is simple. You don't want to have a system where the higher is controlling the lower, because then life can't create itself. And a human life is a human life. It isn't a human soul life. Otherwise it would be redundant and you would have, there would not be the separation that's needed, because the human soul, if it were to come and incarnate, would just be another human being, effectively. The human being, by nature of putting on all these senses, limits itself to the forces the senses are combating and dealing with. Remember what the forces are doing. They're destroying the prosperity of itself. Even if it could come here as a soul, a human as a soul, it would quickly be bombarded by all these things that make it something less than a soul. Now, eventually it learns to be something greater. Eventually, each human being learns how to live in these realms and be a soul, but it does so on its own, with only minimal help from the soul. It really is doing this because it is self-created. The idea that we're self-created is hard, a hard concept. But that's the truth. We are self-created, and this self-creation is the greatest part of prosperity. It is the thing that gives the greatest gift of God. And in that gift is the prime directive that we are all free to create ourselves. And that must be true, or else there will be no life. Life will be destroyed, and the universe would eventually be destroyed. Now, I know that some people will say, yeah, but isn't evil want to do that? Yes, but evil's crazy. It eventually will destroy itself. Because all life is destroyed if you destroy self-creation. And evil wants to destroy self-creation by imprisoning everybody, but and then drawing from it, but eventually there won't be nothing left, and then evil goes too. So God's system is to imbue the prosperity of self-creation. We come here with that. And you can say, well, what about the lower life forms? What are they doing? Lower life forms don't have enough self to be self-created into God. They only have enough to create themselves into whatever the perspective of consciousness of that life form is, which is never God itself. Human beings are the first form of life that can be self-aware of God and therefore can create themselves into a part of God. That's the difference. We have two senses that allow us to do that in each one of our bodies, and it gives us this uniqueness. We also have an individual soul and not a group soul. That gives us another unique advantage. All of that is the ultimate prosperity of being a human being. That prosperity is the single greatest level, the most significant, the one we must all hold on to with the greatest cherish. Tonight's show was really about that, wasn't it? It's to show how we must cherish the greatest prosperity we can possibly have, which is self-creation. Helping not just ourselves to be creative of ourselves, but to help all other selves. Because if all other selves aren't self-creative, we eventually will not be either. And God ensures this how? By not interfering in our self-creation and by making certain limits on how much evil could be destructive of self-creation before it destroys itself. The equation is such that the universe can never go dark. I know some people say, well, how can that be if God isn't interfering with us? Well, because it is not an equal-sided equation. I'll have to think about that, I know. All right, we're running out of time. I'm going to try to sum up tonight's show because there's still a lot more to talk about this subject, but we've got there. We've got a kind of understanding of it. The principles of prosperity involve the principles of becoming our creator. When prosperity is removed from any system, it is always some form of darkness, with eventually it becoming evil. Anything that removes prosperity through, we'll call it force, is an eventual arm of evil. It's a way that evil can impose itself onto the human psyche, spirit, etc. All parts of life deserve and we'll say, move towards prosperity as a means of survival and eventually as a means of meaning. It isn't just human beings that do this, but human beings can be aware of themselves doing it, which is different than other parts of life. We understand or can understand what it means. To negate it or to redistribute it, to do anything to it that is an abhorrent destruction is anti-God. Whether someone claims to be for or with God or not, it's anti-God. Be aware of that as you experience this throughout your life and throughout the world around us. I don't care if it's Egypt or some other place. Watch how things happen, and you'll understand better, more about tonight's show. In every aspect of what it means to be human, prosperity is an important part of it. So one should never feel guilty, or one should not, we'll say, be jealous of prosperity. It should never be that way. We should appreciate it. We should be glad that other people have it. And we should empower ourselves, as well as everybody else, to have as much as can be had within the context of doing it so that everybody else can have it. Because this is the spiritual path, not the mundane one that might be something you find in the dictionary definition of the word. Okay. And finally, I would like to say this. If you still doubt the things that I've said in tonight's show, then I suggest you experiment. Go against some of the principles of prosperity that I have taught tonight and see what happens. Do it for a month in your life and see what takes place. I don't want people destroying the world from this, but if you really believe that I'm wrong, then it might be worth it to try the opposite to see whether or not it's true or not, if you can't see it from just observing others. Because I think that that's another way to possibly find truth, experimentation. I'm not suggesting that everybody would need to do this, because certainly I would hope that that radical approach would not be necessary. But if it's the last thing, and if it's the only thing that's going to get people to see the truth, then maybe that's worth it. Because, after all, even a month of your life is better than the rest of your life. Remember, the meaning in life is inversely proportional to the prosperity in most people. There's a few exceptions, but in most people, that's the truth. So if you want a meaningful life, one that gets you to become the true creator of your life, then prosperity is necessary. And I know a lot of people are going to say, oh, what a God, he's telling us we should be prosperous instead of giving it all away to everybody else. I know. Depends on your viewpoints on things, and you may disagree with me. But that is what I'm saying, and hopefully it has made some sense to you. At any rate, you could also communicate with me if you disagree. I'd be glad to talk to people about this more on any individual level or as a group, whatever way you want to do it. We're out of time for right now, and I hope this has really been a meaningful show for you. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.